Kathy. I'm sitting at the bar at Simon's Tavern in Andersonville drinking some glug, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 786. And of course, what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Say hello on all the channels, Twitter at Outside the Loop, Instagram, Facebook, whatever it's called these days, and download the podcast of the show for free or stream that sucker. It is delivered each week to your device if you subscribe for free. You could also get it through the WGN Radio app, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your on-demand audio, and check out OutsideTheLoopRadio.com and WGNRadio.com for the audio archives of the show. A big good morning to Bob Ferguson, who is our engineer on duty today in the WGN Radio studios. And we have a fantastic show lined up for you today. I saw this article in the Reader early this week. And this article is called Why Sweep the Streets? And it got me thinking about street sweeping in Chicago. And I know that for some of us, that's like the bane of our existence, mainly because it interferes with our parking situation, our street parking situation, I should say. Because if you are parked on the street when the street sweeper comes by, that's a $60 ticket. And those can add up pretty quickly. If you are in most places in Chicago, you'll see that they like to come around and tie those printed off signs on trees and light poles that remind you that tomorrow is street sweeping time. So don't park there. But usually those signs don't go up until the day before, or sometimes they go up even later and maybe it's a little too late. But this article by Courtney Kuppers, I think I'm saying that right, Courtney Kuppers, sorry, Courtney. This article talks about how much it costs for people to hang those signs that tell you, hey, tomorrow is street cleaning. Those people get paid $21.73 per hour. It cost the city $1.4 million in 2019 and in 2020, according to the city. So I don't know, maybe there's a better way. Maybe we could just establish that this particular day every month is going to be street cleaning. I know they've done that in the Westtown neighborhood in Chicago, which, ironically, according to this article, using city data, that is where the most tickets in terms of violating the parking situation, parking on the street during street cleaning, that's where the most tickets have been issued, in the Westtown neighborhood. Between 2016 and 2020, between 100,000 and 120,000 tickets were issued. And how much money does the city get from these violations? It's the second most common parking ticket in the city, with hundreds of thousands of tickets issued per year in recent years, resulting in anywhere from $11 million to $18 million in fines collected annually, according to this article. And this article also gets into the question, does street sweeping actually work? And I get that, and I think it probably does. I think it probably does, but boy, it seems like there are always leaves and other like muddy kind of debris blocking those sewers. And then when it rains, the sewers back up because they can't drain properly. And then you get a little bit of a lake situation in some of these streets. There's a great website called sweeparound.us. Sweeparound.us. You go ahead and enter your address in this website, and it will show you the days that your upcoming street sweeping will happen in Chicago. Sweeparound.us. You can also activate the alerts and it will send notifications to your phone. So I thought that was a great invention. And look, if you're going to get upset about parking on the streets and street sweeping, you just got to pay attention. That's kind of the deal here in Chicago. Unless you're in the Westtown neighborhood, they've established certain days in the month, every month, during street sweeping season that the street cleaners will come by. So check it out, this article in the Reader, but it's better than not sweeping the streets. We got to try, at least. At least I think so. We've got a great show for you today. Stay tuned. This is Outside the Loop. Watch out for those street sweepers. Co-op grocery stores have sprouted up around Chicagoland over the years. These stores are an alternative to larger commercial grocery stores, having ownership consist of anyone from the community and emphasizing sustainability and transparency. The co-op movement's history and struggles are the subjects of the new documentary called The Co-op Wars. Eric Essie is the producer of The Co-op Wars, and you can check out coopwars.com. Eric, welcome to Outside the Loop.
Thank you so much.
Let's talk about the co-op movement here, because I think this is really fascinating history, especially when we think of cultural history. How did all this get started? How did this happen?
Well, co-op history is a very broad thing that's happened in the United States since the 1870s, where people have been starting cooperatives that were owned by their workers or by their consumers in a variety of fields. What this film focuses on is natural food co-ops, which really got going in the late 60s and especially in the 1970s as an outgrowth of the anti-Vietnam War counterculture. For a lot of people, it was a way to fulfill their needs for food outside of the corporate system and outside of capitalism. And by just doing things with each other in the community. And especially was driven by the fact that a lot of foods that we take for granted right now were just not commercially available. Whole wheat bread was hard to find. Bulk foods were very hard to find. A lot of variety of vegetables and other products we find in the regular grocery stores these days were not available. So it was a combination of a political movement and a movement for different kinds of healthier unprocessed foods.
Yeah, and you know, it's obviously caught on that this idea that people can own a stake, you know, own a little bit of the store, and that I think is is really interesting and you know, exciting and empowering for a lot of people. And you know, here in Chicago, and I know you know this, that we've seen some co-ops come up around the area, and so this is obviously something that's resonating with people even today.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in other parts of the country, there was an explosion of food co-ops in the 1970s. Chicago didn't really have that. It had a co-op store down in Hyde Park from the 1930s. But natural food co-op stores didn't really get going in Chicago until the aughts, really, with Dill Pickle Co-op and Sugar Beet Co-op. And now there's this movement of a bunch of different startup co-ops that are getting going. Chicago Market will open soon, and there's a Southside co-op in development. There's one out in I think Lombard. And so there's a bunch of different projects of people coming together to try to fulfill their needs in this way, and it's really exciting.
So again, the film is called The Co-op Wars. So I have to ask you, Eric, what was that struggle? What were the wars that developed inside this co-op movement that you're talking about?
Yeah, it's a really strange juxtaposition of words, cooperation and war. And the co-op wars in particular were a struggle in the Twin Cities, in Minneapolis and St. Paul. In the 1970s there was this boom of natural food co-ops coming out of the counterculture. Between 1971 and 1975, over two dozen were started. And they're immensely popular in the counterculture and fulfill a need that wasn't being met. And with that, they were also involved, because they came out of this leftist political movement, the divisions within that movement after the Vietnam War affected the co-ops themselves. Well, there was a lot of disagreement about what the co-ops were for, and because they're a brand new thing. So were they strictly about natural food? Were they about cheap food? Were they a sort of social center for hippies? Or were they supposed to have some revolutionary political direction? And if so, which one? So into that debate stepped a underground Marxist organization started by a guy named Theophilus Smith, who was from out of town and who had a vision of himself as the leader of a a Marxist revolutionary group. And he was able to talk some people into this and really inspire people who wanted the cause to be more than just a hippie hangout center. They wanted it to be part of the global socialist revolution. And they were disgusted by what they saw as the sort of lackadaisical, self-centered nature of the counterculture and of the hippies. And so they formed a group called the Cooperative Organization and tried to convince people that they should take over the co-ops and turn them into organs of working class revolution. And when they weren't able to convince enough people to go this direction, they actually physically tried to take them over and take over the warehouse that served all the co-ops and take over individual co-ops by force.
Wow.
And causing, yeah, pretty crazy idea.
Yeah.
Having a coup over a little tiny corner store. So they tried this for a while, and they had a lot of support for a while, but they deeply alienated people with their violent tactics and their intolerance, and they eventually lost. But they damaged the co-ops in the short term, but in the long term, the co-ops have really thrived in Minnesota.
Yeah, and again, across the parts of the country as well. And, you know, today, I mean, are there, I don't know, again, if there are any Marxist struggles or revolutionary ideas going on in co-ops today, but, I mean, are there struggles, or has the movement sort of mellowed out a little bit and everyone's sort of on the same page today?
Well, it's definitely mellower today, and it was mellower in most of the country than it was there, although similar tensions happen in several places. But some of the issues that they argued over the time are definitely still live issues. The co-op organization, called themselves the CO, they actually advocated for more corporate food, which is sort of ironic. They saw the fact that a focus on natural food was, they saw as elitist and not a way to attract working class and people of color to the stores. And so they were promoting having cigarettes and having Coca-Cola and having more regular food in the stores in order to attract working class people and thus radicalize them. Whereas other people were saying, you know, the whole reason we have these stores is to have healthier food available for people and have something different that's in the regular stores. And so the tension over how much the stores should be about healthy food, how rigid a definition of healthy food you should have, and how do you make that accessible to people of all income levels is definitely still a live issue and something that co-ops struggle with right now.
Well, if we want to see this film, we can go to coopwars.com. The listing information there about how we can view it is on coopwars.com. I think this is a fascinating story, and it's a really interesting part of history that maybe we don't know about when we think of, you know, the Vietnam era and the 60s and 70s, that there was this tension even in this peace movement or, you know, anti-commercialization movement. And I think this is a really interesting part of American history. Again, the film is called The Co-op Wars, and its producer is Eric Essie. He joined us today. Eric, thank you so much for talking to us, and congratulations on this film.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
Pullout from Afghanistan ended our 20-year involvement in a drawn-out war. The repercussions of this are being felt here in Chicago, as tens of thousands of Afghan refugees have now been brought to the United States. Chicago has seen the arrival of Afghan youth, and there are some serious concerns about this group's well-being. Melissa Sanchez is a reporter at ProPublica. You can check out her work at ProPublica.org, and she recently wrote a piece on this issue. Melissa, welcome back to Outside the Loop.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You are quite welcome. So let's just set the scene here about what's happening. I mentioned that there are Afghan refugees coming to the United States. There are Afghan youth coming to Chicago. How many Afghan youth have been brought to Chicago, and tell us where they are?
Sure. So There, at the moment, there's around 80 or so children and teens who are among those tens of thousands you mentioned who were evacuated from Afghanistan. And those kids, like the ones that we're talking about, did not come with a parent, and a lot of them did not come with an adult who's part of their family or a family friend who they could be with right now. And because of that, the federal government, through its Office of Refugee Resettlement, labels them unaccompanied immigrant minors, and they're sort of shuffled into the country's shelter system for immigrant children. And so at the moment, there's about 80 children spread out across four shelters in the city of Chicago that are run by a nonprofit called the Heartland Alliance. And the work that I did was focused largely on about half of those kids who are at one particular shelter in the Bronzeville neighborhood on the south side.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in a minute, but it's important to note that these kids have really experienced some trauma. I mean, they've gone through a lot. They're being separated in some cases from their families. They've seen some just crazy things. So it's important to note that they have experienced significant trauma that's impacted them.
That's exactly right. And I can't even imagine what they've been through. Some of them, I mean, we have been at war with that country for 20 years. So some of them, they all grew up in the middle of this. And in the past couple of months, as the U.S. pulled out and there were evacuations of a lot of people, some of the children might have been on the way to the airport with their parents. And then there could have been like a checkpoint along the way where the Taliban separated. Okay, like half of the car can go and the other half has to stay. Or at the airport, a parent, a mom or a dad might have had to make a decision like, do I send my kid off on this plane and hope that they're in a better place, even if I can't go? So there, a lot of them are dealing with loss, with a lot of fear about what's happening with the families that they left behind, and then just immense confusion about where am I, what am I doing here, and what's going to happen next? Like, when will I leave this shelter?
Speaking of the shelter, let's talk about that. You mentioned that the Heartland Alliance is running a specific shelter, you mentioned in Bronzeville, and you focus on this facility, and there are some very troubling stories coming out of here that the youth are facing some problems while at this facility. What exactly is going on here?
So a couple of weeks ago, I heard from a worker at this shelter. And after talking to that person and more workers and getting records, what I was able to learn is that there's a lot of suicidal ideation happening. There's a lot of kids who are harming themselves, who are cutting their arms, who are hurting other children, who are harming staff, who are being either verbally or physically aggressive toward others, who are trying to run away or trying to break down windows, and who have required a lot of hospitalization. I got police and ambulance records that show that the ambulance, at least in the past 6 or 7 weeks, has been there every other day or more often, kids are requiring like psychiatric hospitalization, which is really extreme. This isn't typical. This happens sometimes at the shelter. Occasionally, kids will come in and they'll need extra help, or they'll exhibit some of the behaviors I've just listed. But the workers I've spoken with, who've been there for years, some of them say that they have never witnessed this level of trauma all at once. And a lot of them were there back in the summer of 2018 when Trump's zero tolerance policy was in effect. And you might remember the images on TV of like children who'd been separated from their moms at the border. And there was a lot of chaos and confusion then. But the workers now here at this shelter are telling me that it's worse. It's worse now with everything that I'm describing. And then kind of to top it all off, or maybe to exacerbate the situation, is that these kids are coming from Afghanistan, where the main languages that are spoken are Pashto and Dari. And Heartland is known for having a very diverse staff, and they speak a lot of languages outside of, separate from Spanish. Spanish is often the main language the kids who enter the shelters speak. But in this case, Heartland doesn't have any staff at the shelters that speak these languages. And so what that's created is really significant language barriers. And Heartland, like all the shelters, they have access to phones where you can call an interpreter. That takes time. What the workers described to me is that there aren't enough phones to make the calls always. Sometimes they'll use other children as interpreters. I talked to one worker who described having to like use like facial or hand gestures to try to communicate really basic stuff to kids, and this ends up conflicting with this other idea of the kids having a lot of behavioral issues, things are escalating more quickly because there's like a lack of communication. There's clear cultural barriers. So it's just sounded really chaotic and difficult for both the children and the staff who told me, who have written to manage, who wrote a series of emails to management that I got a hold of, basically saying like, we're not equipped to deal with this. We don't have the capacity to deal with this. We're being traumatized by the secondary trauma and we need some help.
So, I mean, these kids have been through a lot. They've been in war zones. They've been separated from their families in some cases. So there are a lot of residual effects that are manifesting themselves. And we're seeing that in particular at this facility. But I mean, does this speak to the larger system? Because the Heartland Alliance has a good reputation. And this particular facility in Bronzeville is the one that you really focus on in this piece at ProPublica.org. But in terms of why this is happening, lack of resources, et cetera, is this the result of a broken system?
That's a really good question. And I think Heartland would say yes. Part of their statement to me, one of their statements to me yesterday, is that the prior administration of Trump, like, you know, was dismantling a lot of the system. And I think that's going to probably be true. But I think it's complicated because when I reported the first story last week, I learned that, you know, at the time, Heartland had more Afghan children than any other shelter in the country. And there's like more than 100 shelters in the country. Heartland's a big nonprofit with 4 shelters in the city. But there was another shelter that opened up in Michigan a few months back. It's like an emergency shelter. And they're only dealing with Afghan kids right now. And this place is different. The place I'm talking about in Bronzeville is like a big, old, converted nursing home, 4-story, very institutionalized looking, big, ugly building. Mm-hmm. This place in Michigan is more like a campus with little residential cottages spread out like on green space. But what an immigration lawyer who has spent time there, their lawyers are going there every day, I think, to talk to the kids, is that almost from day one, every single one of these residential cottages where the children have been staying, every single one has had an interpreter who speaks Pashto or Dari from day one. And so what this tells me is the federal government, ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, is capable of alleviating some of these issues, and they demonstrated that, but they didn't do this in the case of Heartland. And at this point, some of the Afghan kids we're talking about have been there for 70 days. And I do want to say, like, that for the language part, just in the past couple of days, they did get interpreters into the shelters. I think this was a result of the publicity and lawmakers calling for changes.
I was going to ask you about the response. I mean, what are lawmakers talking about in the wake of this reporting? What are officials doing, you know, when you expose this? Because this is honestly something that probably most of us don't think about, but this is happening in this case in our own backyard.
Yeah, no, and I had no idea either until this worker called me. Who would have thought that among all the people we're evacuating that we would bring children without their parents? But we did.
Yeah.
So far, Bobby Rush, the representative in Congress who represents the district that includes Bronzeville, he called for changes, including on-site interpreters. Dick Durbin asked the Office of the Inspector General, that's part of the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the refugee program. He asked them to investigate what's happening both on the language front and with the mental health crisis inside of this shelter. And then also Senator Tammy Duckworth has called for immediate action, including prioritizing in-person interpretation and helping Heartland figure out how to deal with this mental health situation that's going on with these children. And over the weekend, workers told me that interpreters started showing up. And so Heartland confirmed to me yesterday that starting on Saturday, you know, we published our story Thursday of last week. And then as of this past Saturday, interpreters started showing up. And by the end of the week, there were supposed to be 36.
Well, we'll see what happens. This is definitely a mental health crisis. This is a humanitarian crisis. And in this case, it's affecting us here in our backyard. So I really appreciate all of the reporting that you're doing, Melissa. And everyone can check out this piece up at ProPublica.org. It's called Dozens of Traumatized Afghan Kids Struggle Inside a Shelter That's Ill-Equipped to Care for Them. It's written by Melissa Sanchez, reporter at ProPublica. Melissa, thank you as always for your great reporting, and thanks for talking to us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Yes, connecting once again across town to the lair of an apartment of one Mr. Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music, in the Chicago Reader and online at chicagoreader.com. And this week, Steve, it's a very obscure band, but right now we're hearing some jamming tunes, and I like that, from Jamestown Massacre. How about that?
Jamestown Massacre, yes. This is pretty much the epitome. Sometimes people use this term incorrectly, but they are pretty much the epitome of the one-hit wonder. Sometimes people will say, you know, like a band, oh, Thin Lizzy, one-hit wonder. And I'm like, no. A, they're a two-hit wonder in the U.S. B, in the U.K., they had loads of hits. So no. Don't call Thin Lizzy a one-hit wonder, you know? But this is very much the case where it is like, they had one sort of charting hit, and that was really about it.
Yeah, that's right. So we will dig into the story of Jamestown Massacre. So let's start at the beginning. They are from, originally, the Burbs, beautiful Downers Grove, Illinois.
Yes, I was shocked to, kind of dig a little bit, because I've had this single forever, and I knew they were local, and I knew they had ties to another bigger band we'll get to later. But, I wasn't sure exactly where they're from. So, yeah, I was sort of delighted. I definitely had friends from Downers Grove, which we always used to make fun of just based on the name alone. Their first gigs were playing at the Downers Grove Youth Center in exchange for a place to practice.
Which love
is,
that.
You know, just, yeah, that's just endearing. Does that happen anymore? I want to think it does, but it probably doesn't. You know, it just seemed, and this is probably about 67. 68 or so.
Yeah. And so they're playing now, like you said, the late 1960s. They started off playing mostly covers, which, you know, a lot of bands were doing back then. They were playing, you know, songs from CSNY, Ides of March, Zeppelin.
Yeah, they were doing cool covers and songs that are difficult to do. I mean, try doing, like, I mean, they were like a 7-piece band, you know, with horns. So it's like, that's not easy stuff to do, you know. Even a good way to get your chops, basically, I'd say, doing the covers of the day in, like, you know, 1969, 1970. You know, quite a variety of stuff on the radio at that time, you know?
Absolutely. And so into 1970, into the 70s, they connect with, this is great, a local jingle producer, and they were working on some commercials locally.
Yeah, they had these super tight harmonies, and they were just a tight band, so they were natural for that kind of thing. And they, I guess, were doing some commercials for Schlitz Malt Liquor and Nestle Crunch.
What a combo.
I know. Ooh, I actually thinking of those two tastes together would be gross. But yeah, they, you know, and then they were, you know, on the side recording their own stuff, going into like Chess Studios and this other pretty famous studio called Paragon Studios, which shut down like 2015, and it was in Fulton Market. I looked it up. I was like, wow, that studio was there that long. You know, they were recording there in like 71, this Paragon studio. So yeah, so they were, you know, they had connections seemingly in both worlds, but then oddly they went to Detroit. They were sort of offered a little recording deal there. So they went there to record what would sort of be their big single.
Well, let's talk about the big single. For them, at least, for Jamestown Massacre. So they record this song, and this song is called Summer Sun. And this is, like, for them, this is it. This is the big hit.
Right, and I should add, I feel like, you know, we're saying this name, Jamestown Massacre, and, you know, immediately my mind went to Jonestown, of course. And right. It's not that. The Jamestown Massacre was actually something that happened in the colonies in, like, 1812 or something like that. So it's a historical reference.
A little earlier than that. A little earlier.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
Like 1622-ish.
Yeah. So I'm like, oh, yes, 1622.
It's the history teacher in me coming out.
Yeah. You know, only about 300 years before this, you know, the single was recorded. But, yes, you know, still kind of a heavy name for what is a very light and frothy, like, summer pop song, you know, and with, like, nice harmonies, you know, nice cool changes, a little bit of jazziness, and you can totally see why. Locally, it was a big hit, and then it just kind of cracked the top 100 at, like, number 90 or something like that. When darkness filled my life, she brought the summer sun.
I mean, I've heard that song a lot. I feel like, oh, this song? This is, not everyone knows this? Oh, all right, well.
Yeah, wait, what, right? You know, yeah, it's strange. So, you know, and it still has legs a little bit, you know, bands cover it and stuff like that. So it's known and loved in certain places.
So Jamestown Massacre, by the mid-1970s, they are kind of, I don't want to say they're disbanding, but I guess they're morphing. They're changing into something else, a new band of sorts.
Yeah, it's hardly documented, but they sort of morphed into this band Mariah that has a really cool cover. You know, I said she looks like she'd be on the side of a van. It's got like guitars and wings sprouting out of it. And it's, you know, some kind of heavy rock. And I guess some of the guys from Jamestown Massacre went out to LA to sort of make it with this band with another local singer guy from the Burbs, Dave Bickler, who became the singer Mariah, and he went on to some future glory. But by the time the album came out, just one album, only one member left of Jamestown Massacre was in the band or credited on the record at the point that the LP came out in like 1975. So it seems like most of the guys, it's a little mysterious what happened to them, but there's no musical record or otherwise of them doing anything after that.
I should mention that the song that we first heard at the beginning of the segment, that was a Mariah song. It was a jam. I was liking it. I dig it. But Mariah, which is interesting here, three songs on that album written by Jim Peterik, of course, who is well known around here out of Survivor fame. What ends up happening then? A little more information, but ultimately the band sort of fades out?
Well, so yeah, so Peterik knew the Mariah singer Dave Bickler from the Jingle circuit. They both had hit that circuit, so they were buddies. And they, I think maybe Peterik writes like one song on the LP, but you know, he knew them and he was probably doing stuff in LA at that point and sort of rising a little bit, and he was forming a new band, and Bickler was his man for, wait for it, Survivor.
Wow.
And Bickler, he's the man singing Eye of the Tiger. That's him. He was the lead singer.
Really?
Yeah. He's a local boy. I forgot which burb he originated from. He jumped around a little bit from what I read, but he's pretty famous in his own right. He was with Survivor for like 4 records. There was all this music biz kind of BS that happened. And then he sort of came back in the 90s and just did a solo thing. And Peterick is, those guys still collaborate. They're still buddies.
So, all right, the full story of the band Jamestown Massacre, a little bit of a web in there, but it's an interesting story. It's all at ChicagoReader.com or in a hard copy of the Chicago Reader. And I should say that the song that we're going to go out on here is a cover of Summer Sun.
Yeah, I was like, you know, I was kind of poking around to see what's out there, and their second single has just... It just sank without a trace. I can't even tell you how little there is on their second single after Summer Sun. But then I'm looking and I'm like, whoa, here's bands like covering it. So yeah, there's like an all Asian cover band out on the West Coast called Elemental Funk. And they nail it. And part of me had me thinking, did they hear this on the West Coast? Did they hear this in Japan, you know, where it was kind of a hit? I was sort of curious, you know, where they picked it up from. But they got the harmonies down. They do it like note for note. And it's a very sort of studio concocted song with a sort of famous engineer making it sound really good. So I was impressed. But yeah, you know, you can find that sort of thing online, but very little on the Jamestown Massacre.
All right, the Jamestown Massacre, Summer Sun. We could maybe use some of that now, but that's okay. Steve Krakow.
Yeah, I'm feeling it. Definitely feeling that. Let me tell you. I'm like, wait, is Winter here already? Oh, Jesus.
The Secret History of Chicago Music in the Chicago Reader. Steve Krakow, also known as Plastic Crime Wave, is the author of that strip. Steve, as always, thank you so much for your knowledge and expertise. We'll see you in that sweet summer sun.
One day.
And that will just about do it. Outside the Loop show number 786 is complete. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. I really appreciate it. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer. Have a fantastic week, and I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop on 720 WGN.